All right. Well, thank you. I think people who come on time should be rewarded, and so we should get going. I'm going to talk about supernovae and the dark energy. This is a subject that has, where there was a confrontation between observation and theory about 70 years ago. Einstein, who's represented by the Richmond Agency, and de Sitter, wrote a paper in 1932 where they were talking about the cosmological constant, and they said, an increase in the precision of data derived from observation will enable us in the future to fix its sign and determine its value. And that future, I think, is now. What I want to talk about is using supernovae to help fix the sign and determine the value of the cosmological constant or something like it. This is a big enterprise. The group I've been working with, the high Z, high redshift supernova search, includes a lot of people who are listed here, many of whom were my students, but who are now telling me what to do. Brian Schmidt, among others, Bruno Leibengut, who's at ESO, was my postdoc, this whole gang, including Saurabh Jha, who just finished his PhD at Harvard and is now a Miller Fellow at Berkeley. Chris Smith was my student. Adam Rees, who's at the Space Telescope Science Institute now and who is leading the way on some of the applications of the space telescope to searching for high redshift supernovae. Okay. Alex Filipenko was a student at the University of California at Santa Barbara and now professor of astronomy at the University of California, Berkeley, and I'm going to talk about his work first. I believe he played on the tennis team as well as other things, as well as the physics team. Okay, so I just want to talk about this legendary confrontation for a second. The mythology is, of course, that Einstein stuck the cosmological constant in by hand to make a static solution for general relativity. And then, according to the legend promulgated in all elementary textbooks, when Hubble discovered that the universe was expanding, Einstein smote himself on the forehead and said, "Oh, what a terrible mistake, my greatest blunder." And here is the occasion where the principals in this discussion are in the same room. Here's George Ellery Hale, who built the world's largest telescope four times, the instrument for finding this stuff out. He's patting Edwin Hubble on the head. And here's Einstein, and here's the blackboard on which he wrote. This was not in Santa Barbara, although Einstein did come to Santa Barbara famously and stood on the beach in his overcoat on this trip. This is at Santa Barbara Street in Pasadena at the Mount Wilson Observatory offices. Now, you can see that the blackboard's been erased, and there's some thing here. It turns out that Einstein was so famous that while he was giving talks, people took pictures of the blackboard. And here is, from the Caltech archives, the picture of Einstein's blackboard in 1931. I'm not too sure exactly what he's doing here, but in any case, you notice that when he writes things out, he has a cosmological constant. He has a big lambda in it. Now, I'm not quite sure what he's doing, and maybe it's a different lambda, but it looks to me like in 1931, even though the expanding universe was well established, Einstein had not quit using the lambda. Yeah? I don't know. All right, so let me tell you what the plan of the talk is. The first thing I want to convince you is that there's a lot of new data coming in on supernovae, that we've been working quite hard on this for a long time, and there's a lot going on. For example, the low redshift sample, which allows us to understand the properties of the objects which we're observing at high redshift, has been doubled in the last few years, and I'll show you the consequences of that. And in particular, we've extended the wavelength coverage of the low redshift observations into the ultraviolet, the part of the ultraviolet that you can do from the ground. And the reason why that's important, of course, is that for high redshift objects, that's the only part of the light from the supernova which you can see. So then I'll talk a little bit about the use of making a particular kind of supernova, the kind we call type 1A, classified by their spectra, into the best standard candles for cosmology. And I'll say a few words about using that nearby. And then the thing you really want to know about, the Hubble diagram for distant type 1A supernovae and the evidence for a cosmological constant or for something like it. And then I'll talk about the plans for measuring the cosmic equation of state. There are two programs that I'm involved in which are underway. One at Cerro Tololo, what we call the ESSENCE program, S-N-S, sounds like quintessence. Also sounds like maybe a men's cologne or something. Anyway, we're going to observe about 200 of these type 1a supernovae at a redshift where the effect is big to look at the onset of acceleration. And there's also a program being carried out on the Space Telescope where we're piggybacking the supernova observations on the program, the so-called GOODS program, which is supposed to make deep observations much like the Hubble Deep Field, only with the new camera now on the Space Telescope. And instead of taking all those images at once, the way they did for the Deep Field, they'll be done in episodes separated by about 45 days. And so in addition to adding up all those exposures to make a very deep image of the sky, we will subtract them one from another and find the transient events, some of which will be these type 1a supernovae at high redshift in the range from about 1 up to 1.8. And I'll show you a little bit about that. Okay, so that's the plan. Supernova studies are thriving. Let me say a word about Alex Filipenko, a graduate of the University of California at Santa Barbara. There is a nearby supernova search which Alex and Weidong Li have been running at the Lick Observatory, the so-called KATE. I guess it used to be called the 8, but then they got some funding. Anyway, and then automatic, well, anyway, in the last 5 years or so, they've gotten going, and every year they have set a record, except for 2000, a tough year, they've set a world record for the number of nearby supernovae discovered. They do this with an automated telescope that goes from one nearby galaxy to another. Software aligns images and subtracts them and gives a flag when there's a nearby object, when there's a new object in the field. Some of those are asteroids, some of them are cosmic rays, but some of them are also supernovae. And so of the low redshift supernovae in the world, about half have been found with this instrument. This year, they're up to 56 as of August 15th and on course for yet another world record. So there's a great deal of discovery. Now, discovery means nothing except for the rates. What you really have to do is follow up, and that's what we've been doing at the Center for Astrophysics. We have a 1.5-meter telescope, which is equipped with a good spectrograph, and a 1.2-meter telescope with a good CCD camera. And that allows us to get the spectra and the light curves for a large number of these objects. In the last year, we've sent out 73 of these International Astronomical Union circulars, which are the notice to everybody. And most of those are the first measurement of one of these things that tells what kind of supernova it is based on the spectrum. Of the ones that the Weidong Li and Alex and company have found over the last couple of years, it turns out that 93 of them are type 1a, 76 are type 2, that's the kind that have hydrogen in their atmospheres. Then there are a bunch of other kind of interesting types. These 1c's are of special interest because they might be the ones that are most closely related to the gamma ray bursts. What's interesting is that the ones that are unclassified, only 6 out of this number. That is, we've gone from a situation where the number found was fairly small and the number measured of those found was small to something where we're very well set up with their discoveries and our follow-up and their own follow-up to really get good information on these things. Let me just show you what kind of information we get without discussing it too much. We're interested in what kind of objects become the type 1a supernovae, because if you don't understand their astronomical provenance, what stars they come from and how they blow up, you could be misled by the effects of age, stellar composition over time. And so you want to have good clues that will tell you about the explosions, what the events are that you're studying. So here's the sort of thing that we do. This, of course, is better than average, but each night we get a spectrum, so this is over the wavelength range from 4,000 out to almost 8,000 angstroms. And so this is the spectrum, which was quite mysterious when these things were first found, but which we now know is that the result of burning a carbon-oxygen white dwarf. The carbon and oxygen are degenerate in white dwarfs. When it reaches the Chandrasekhar mass, almost, there's a burning wave that goes out through the star and burns the interior up to nuclear statistical equilibrium, mostly iron. But the outside of the star apparently is not completely burned, because you see carbon and oxygen and silicon intermediate mass elements. Anyway, this very strong line here, absorption is due to silicon, and the others can also be identified. And that allows us to understand a little bit more about what these stars are by getting long series. As the star expands, you see deeper into the star, and eventually the spectrum does become iron, as you might have expected. Okay, we're very interested in the homogeneity of these objects. The use of it is, of course, to imagine that these things have the same luminosity or can be corrected to the same luminosity, and to measure the luminosity distance for each one. That is the technique used to see the acceleration. But we know that there are variations on this theme, that not all white dwarfs burn in exactly the same way. And the evidence for that comes from looking at a bunch of supernovae. So here are a number of different supernovae. What we know is the same age, because we have the light curves also, which I'll show you. And what you can see, for example, if you look at this line that I previously mentioned, this is the thing which is due to once ionized silicon, that the depth and width of that feature are different in different supernovae. That corresponds to different physics of the explosion in ways that we hope to be able to connect to the luminosity at later times, or the luminosity at maximum. Okay, now most of the measurements I'll be talking about have to do with the brightness of the supernova, and I just want to say one word about technique. Arlen Kratz showed you, was it yesterday? It seems like only yesterday. Maybe it was the day before. Images that were of M31, where he had found transient objects by subtraction. And of course, the discovery of the supernovae is done in that way, by taking images from a month ago and images tonight and subtracting them. We also do the photometry of the measurement of the brightness in the subtracted image. And you can see why that might be useful. Here's a nearby galaxy. Here's a nearby galaxy with a supernova in it, and it's really hard to see where the supernova is, but in the subtracted image, there it is. It's this dot right here, which you can sort of see after you know where to look. Now, the problem is that you want to measure the brightness of that supernova, but it's superposed on this very complex and fairly bright background. And so what we do is actually make the measurements of brightness in the subtracted image and compare it to the brightness of other objects that are in the field whose brightness we can measure later. So typically what we do is assess what the background is from an image taken before or after and use that to get a good clean measurement of the flux from the supernova. And we do that both for the low redshift ones and also for the high redshift ones. Here's an example from nearby supernova of what these light curves look like, and they're very distinctive. The light curves for type 1a supernovae have a long exponential part in the blue or in the visual. They have more complex behavior out in the red and the near infrared, where they typically have a second bump. And what's new in the data I'm going to mention in a minute is that we've acquired a large amount of information about what they do in the ultraviolet. This is the ultraviolet that you can observe from the ground, which goes down to about 3,200 angstroms. So we have a program of finding these things, of observing these things, and by golly, of reducing the data. So here are some of the light curves that are in Sarabjah's thesis. Now, the point of all this earnest effort is to try to use the shape of the light curve to tell you something about the luminosity of the supernova. This was something which was proposed by Mark Phillips in 1992, and for which the evidence has gotten stronger over time. There are a number of techniques for doing it. Basically, if you measure somehow the rate of decline, say in the B band, it turns out that the supernovae which are intrinsically luminous have a slow rate of decline, and the ones which are intrinsically faint have a more rapid rate of decline. Being able to measure this is very important, because it allows you to tell which supernovae are a little brighter than others, and they do range over a factor of 5. Here's a particular way of doing this that Adam Riess and Bill Press and I started about 6 years ago, and that Saurabh Jha has improved for his thesis work. And here is a family of these curves in U, B, V, R, and I, empirically determined from the observations, is this family of curves that connects the shape of the light curve to its luminosity. So on this scale is the luminosity in astronomers' units, absolute magnitude. And you can see that the one that's very bright here at the top has a slow decline, and the one that is dim down here has a rapid decline. And by doing this measurement in many bands, you can not only figure out whether you're dealing with a luminous one or a dim one, but you can also infer the amount of reddening by dust along the line of sight. And that turns out to be a very useful thing. So what's new here is that there is now a U-band light curve. So this is a 50 supernovae, 500 points of the U-band. It's a little bit of a mess, but on the other hand, there is such a thing as an ultraviolet light curve for type 1 supernovae. And the reason why this is important is that, first of all, well, mostly for the high redshift application. So I had a vision last night in which I realized I could show you why this was true. And this morning I discovered there were enough colored pens to make my vision come true. So here's the idea. Here you're the observer, and you have these different filters through which you can observe a supernova. And then somebody's going to go take a spectrum and find out what the redshift is. Now, when you look at objects which are at zero redshift, the colors that are emitted, U, B, V, R, and I, are observed in those same filters. But as you go to higher redshift, of course, the whole spectrum, let's see if I can do this right, as you go to redshift 2.2 or so, what's emitted in the U is observed in the B. As you go to redshift 1/2, oh boy, is this exciting. What's emitted in U, B, and V is observed in V, R, and I, the filters that with standard filters that we have in visual red and infrared. And as you go to redshift 1 and so on, near redshift 1, it turns out that by using the reddest standard filters that you can use from the ground with CCDs, the light that you're seeing from the supernova is emitted in the U band. So it's important to understand what these things are doing at those wavelengths, and we've done it. Let me show you the application of this at low redshift. At low redshift, if you assume all supernovae have the same luminosity, that is, are just standard candles, and you plot the apparent magnitude against the log of the redshift, that should be, just by the inverse square law, the slope should just be this line, which is 5 in these funny units. Now, the scatter about that line turns out to be pretty big, about 22%. If you, on the other hand, use this method that I've sketched, that is, you use the light curve shape, it turns out you can decrease the scatter in this quite a bit. Instead of plotting a point over here, like this one, which is faint for its distance, if you assume they're all the same, when something is dim, you put it at you think it's at a large distance. But it might be that it's intrinsically dim, and the shape of the light curve tells us which ones are intrinsically dim. By making the measurements in many bands, we can also figure out which ones are dimmed by dust. So here's the outcome of that, is that you take this sample, apply this machinery of the light curve shape method, and the Hubble diagram gets a lot better. Let me just show you one example. So here's an example, not an extraordinarily good one, where we've made these measurements, U, B, V, R, and I. We've fit the light curve with one of these families of light curve shapes and inferred the luminosity of the supernova. We also know the redshift. Well, we inferred the luminosity of the supernova, and so we get the distance for this supernova and the reddening for it. So the method works pretty well. And it has the desired effect. Okay, the other thing to say about the ultraviolet and why this might be especially useful or especially important is that we do know that when we look at distant supernovae, we are looking at objects which are on average younger and on average of lower chemical abundance, because the chemical abundances have increased over time. So one of the things we're interested in is what would be the effect of that on the light curves, because you wouldn't want to be misled into thinking you were seeing cosmic acceleration when all you were seeing was the overall history of chemical enrichment in the galaxy. And the U-band may help us do that. Here's a model spectrum computed for a type 1a supernova, and it's a pretty good representation of what the spectra actually look like. And if you by hand change the chemical composition by a factor of 3, decrease the abundances by a factor of 3, it turns out the only place where it makes any difference, there are two plots here, the only place where it makes any difference is out here in the ultraviolet. So we hope to be able to explore the effect of chemistry on the light curves of supernovae from this sample that we've been working on. Okay, in any case, we've now doubled the sample. There were about 20 well-observed objects in 1995 with good CCD light curves. There were about 40 in 1998, and now we've got 80 on the Hubble diagram out to a redshift that corresponds, this is the low redshift end, out to a redshift of a tenth. So this is the low end, low redshift end of the sample. Here's the scatter. It's about 0.18 magnitudes, or about 9% in the distance. Now, the intercept of this, not quite shown, gives the Hubble constant if you know the luminosity of a supernova. So I'm going to digress for a second and say a word about that. The deviations from the Hubble flow can show our motion relative to the frame in which the supernovae are located, or more ambitiously, could show the flows of the galaxies in which the supernovae are located, much in the way that people have looked to discover the lumpiness of the universe by studying, say, Tully Fisher or other measurements of the galaxy properties that would tell you which ones were near and which ones were far. So just as an example, here is mapped on the sky the residual from that Hubble line for the supernovae. And what you can see is there's a side that is shown red. I forget whether that means it's redshifted or hotter. Anyway, and a side that's blue. And what you'd expect is, if we were doing this right, that you'd see our motion relative to the CMB frame if the supernova galaxies, on average, are at rest in the CMB frame. And these squares are the CMB dipole part. So we're way behind in measuring the details, but we've measured the dipole pretty well. And eventually, we will be able to measure the peculiar motions of galaxies on scales of a few thousand kilometers a second, as people have done, and with much better precision than the methods that have been used based on galaxies. What about the Hubble constant? Well, this is quite an embarrassing story. Our job is to tell you in the units of the Hubble diagram that I showed you, where the intercept is. Let me just go back for a second. And we've done that. You could double this sample again and again and again. You're not going to change the precision of the intercept very much, because the Hubble diagram is really very well established. But the Hubble constant depends on knowing the luminosity of one of those supernovae, or alternatively, to know the distance to one of those galaxies measured some other way. And as everybody knows, this has been undertaken using the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, here is the outcome of all this labor. For a handful of supernovae, 72E and then these others, the Key Project and Sandage's team acquired observations with space telescope to find Cepheid variables, to find them, measure their periods and luminosities, and to figure out, based on the Cepheids, what the distances to the galaxies were. These were galaxies in which supernovae had occurred, and so once you're done with that, you would know what the luminosity of a supernova was, and you'd know what the Hubble constant is. Now, the embarrassing thing is that these two sets of data, the Key Project shown in red, the Sandage and Company analysis shown in blue, are based on the same data. They have actually analyzed the same space telescope data. The only difference is the Cepheid distances which they derive, and they derive it for different distances for different reasons, some of which have to do with corrections made for metallicity, some with corrections made for reddening, and so on. So this is the state of play. Now, the usual thing to do when there are so if you use the key project value, you get about 76 with a 10% uncertainty, widely quoted. If you use Sandage and Companies, you get about 66 with a 10% uncertainty. And all that's left to us as a tool for discriminating between one and another is character assassination, our usual method. So this is really a problem. It means that we've done our job the best we possibly can. We have a distance indicator which works fine out in the Hubble flow. And the whole problem is now with a very nearby problem, the problem of measuring correctly the distances using Cepheid variable stars or some other method to nearby galaxies. So there's still plenty to do. Also, both of these scale up and down with the distance to the nearest galaxy in which there are a lot of Cepheids, which is the Large Magellanic Cloud. And so it's important to get other ways to measure the distances to the nearest galaxies in order to do the cosmology right. And I just happen to have this picture of the Large Magellanic Cloud here, in which I show supernova 1987A. And one of the methods to get a distance to the Magellanic Cloud is by geometrical measurements of these interesting ring systems that happen to be around supernova 1987A. This just happened to be on a book cover, which is coming out in October. Okay, so now let's go to the global test. The idea, of course, is we know that nearby, I showed you nearby, we have a very reliable distance indicator, the type 1a supernovae. And the game, of course, is to see the difference that cosmology makes in the luminosity distance at larger redshifts. And that's an old game. People have been trying to do this for a long time. There was a group in Denmark that went to the European Southern Observatory every month for 2 years in the late 80s. For this purpose. They found one supernova in 2 years, and though they did retire the trophy for frequent flyer miles, they didn't quite finish the program. Here's again, the same stuff. This is the low redshift universe, and then here are some different models for what you would get. These are supposed to be omegas for different cosmological properties in the universe. Now, this is our measurement of the low redshift end. In fact, we measured those too, the low redshift end. And that sample is going to get doubled. This is not with the new data. That will help a little bit in pinning down the low redshift end. That's not the main source of difficulty. The main source of difficulty is finding and measuring distant supernovae where the effect is predicted to be big. And as everybody knows, there are two gangs at work on this. Saul Perlmutter, is he going to be here this afternoon? Well, we don't know. Anyway, maybe Saul will be here this afternoon to tell us what's going on at the Supernova Cosmology Project. That's the group centered at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. And then there's the anarchic group, of which I am a member, the HiZ Supernova team, which has done a lot of work on the low redshift end. And we've done some on the high redshift end, too. And whoops, so let me just show you this. This is old stuff. Everybody knows this. So here's the data from the two groups. The data from the two groups, and it's easier to look at it down here. If there were, if you lived in an empty universe, this would be the expected shape of this line. And the fact that the supernovae are faint compared to that line means that the luminosity distance is a little bigger than you'd expect. That is, during the time the light's in flight, the expansion has been more than you would guess. It's a signature of acceleration. We have fewer points, but our points have smaller error bars than the other guys. And it turns out when you look at the statistical power of these two samples, they're just about the same. They agree pretty well. And both of them show that you need to have some cosmological constant or something that's producing acceleration in the epoch between redshift 1, or really 0.8, and now. I'm going to show you some better ones. No, it's not. I'll show you that. Okay. I would say, as far as the direct phenomena goes, the supernova observations are the only ones that provide evidence for acceleration. But the combination of ingredients is what I think has been convincing to people, that if you combine the CMB measurements that show we live in a flat universe with these supernova data, you get a consistent picture. And in fact, it's consistent with what people were getting from cluster dynamics already, namely a value of omega matter of around 0.3 and omega lambda of 0.7. So that's shown kind of schematically here. So schematically, we have no numbers on here. But anyway, so here's where an old CMB line intersects an old Zeppelin of uncertainty for the supernovae. And the interesting thing is that the place where this comes out is at omega matter of 0.3, about where people might have guessed if they'd had their courage or their conviction. So not to be too simple-minded, so here's the sort of budget, padded out by donations, that's good. But anyway, we have so we have a universe which is 30% dark matter and maybe 60% dark energy. The curious thing is, of course, we don't know what either of those is, so that's good. Now the game is to find out whether this might be the result of some problem with the supernovae or really due to cosmology. And one way to do that is to go to higher redshift. The balance between omega matter and omega lambda will change over time depending on the equation of state for each one, how the pressure changes with the volume. And, or the density, but yeah, how the energy density changes with the volume. And for matter, of course, it's just 1 plus z cubed. That is, as the volume changes, the density changes. For the energy density in the dark energy, it could be that it's constant. If that's true, as you go to higher redshift, look into the past, higher z, you can come to a place where omega matter, the attractive part, and omega lambda, the repulsive part, are more or less balanced. And so if you look far enough back, you should see deceleration. And it turns out that for the numbers we're talking about, it's quite nearby. The era, or epoch, of deceleration is only just out at redshift 1, where we already can see some of these objects. So what you'd expect is, instead of seeing supernovae that are faint because of acceleration and the distance being larger than you would expect, you'll see supernovae which will actually be brighter than you would otherwise get, due to the effect of deceleration if you look at higher redshift. So that's good. There's a real signature that we should look for, that systematic effects of any kind ought to go the other way. And amazingly, this has already been done. In fact, it was being done at the very time we were trying to figure out these first results. It was done, of course, without the intervention of human intelligence. And that is, people had gone back to redo the Hubble Deep Field in 1997 and had taken a second epoch to look for supernovae. That was something which was a good idea. Mark Phillips and others did that, and they found a couple. When I was on the time allocation thing, they said, "Do you think this is a good idea?" I said, "No, you'll just find them and you won't be able to follow them up." And I was right, except that they had recently brought up the new infrared camera, the infrared camera on the space telescope, and they were going to make an infrared deep field. And on the same week when the supernova was discovered by this imaging technique with the CCD, shown here, the NICMOS guys, the infrared camera guys, started their deep field exposures. And for the next month, they took exposures over and over and over again, creating a wonderful light curve in the infrared, which is what you need for one of these very distant supernovae, which has been analyzed by Adam Rees and others. Well, it's really a publication now. And that here's the diagram, maybe the one you're thinking of, but I still have a better one yet, so, you know. So here are the low redshift ones. Here are the intermediate redshift ones where we think we see the effect. What's shown here for various cosmologies is the switching over from accelerating to decelerating, and the coasting point is marked with a dot. So for example, here's one that's pretty likely, you know, in good agreement with the data, omega matter of 0.35, omega lambda of 0.65. The coasting point is actually already within the realm of our observations. And you'd expect that as you look to higher redshift, you'd begin to see the deceleration part, this other effect. Now, the data for supernova 1997 FF, the one found in the Space Telescope data, include a pretty big error bar. Nevertheless, it doesn't lie up here. It lies down on the low side. And that makes you think that maybe we're on the right track and that it's really cosmology and not something that has to do with the fact that the supernovae are younger at greater distances. Well, everybody wants to do more of that, both the stuff you can do from the ground, which is to get up to redshift 1 or so, and the very distant ones, which you have to do from space. And let me just show you, we haven't been completely idle for the past 5 years, but we haven't published much either. And I'll show you these preliminary results. This is very, it's not very preliminary. We're going to get these out, I hope, by the end of the month, but we'll see. Anyway, here are some more points from our team. And what's especially interesting is we have some points out here, which are at redshift 1. If you just analyze these points separately, you get a result which is completely consistent with what we found back in 98. So that's good. It's an independent measurement. We see the same thing. What's better is that this paper, for which John Tonry at the University of Hawaii has been the leader, includes some fairly well-measured points out at redshift 1. Let me show you on that same kind of diagram that I had before what this does for you. So here's the low redshift stuff. That'll get better from the sample that I showed you. Here we've combined our data and the data from the Supernova Cosmology Project. They have about equal weight. And this is in the zone where the effect is the biggest at a redshift of around a half or so. And then here are these high redshift points. The error bars are pretty big, but they're mostly as upper limits. And here's the very high redshift HST point out here. So I would say it's not conclusive at all, but things are looking good, as if it might really be cosmology, that we might really be reaching the epoch of deceleration. It means there's certainly no alarm bells going off. So just to show you, if we take those data and do the usual kind of thing, if you take the supernova data alone, now including these redshift 1 objects, as Gobar and Perlmutter showed back in 96, observing over a wide range in redshift is a good thing, and it helps close off the error contours of this ellipse. And if you use the supernovae alone, you're up here in this mysterious range. If you include the constraint from the CMB that the total omega should be 1, this is the error ellipse 1, 2, and 3 sigma, and so it's in the same range. So I would say the results haven't really changed, but that we have yet an independent assessment of it, and we've extended the redshift range, and there's a lot more to be done on that line of work. So how are we going to do a really good job, not just one or two of these things, but enough so that you really could believe it, to build up the sample? And we've, in the last year, we've done a big enterprise. John Tonry and Brian Barris and a bunch of the rest of us have been lucky enough to use the prime focus camera on Subaru, the 8-meter telescope in Hawaii. And instead of just doing a before and an after, where you find the object and then follow each one up, they went back to the same field over and over again, many times over the space of 4 months. The camera is a big one. The telescope is very fast. It allows you to make measurements to faint magnitudes over a big area of the sky. And we found 38 or some number of supernovae in there. You have to build a pretty good data pipeline because the images are big and there's a lot of data coming in, and you have to find them more or less overnight. The basic idea is this, similar to what I showed you before. Here's a before image and here's an after image, and the subtraction can show you a very good signal. And as long as you've done a very good job of aligning and calibrating the two images, you have to blur one to match the other, you have to get the alignment right, you have to do it's sort of a mess, but it works. And let me just show you what some of these light curves from this campaign look like, because they really are pretty good. So here's Julian days, for those of you who prefer it, or September, October, November, December, for those of you who like that. So here, starting from September through February, shows the brightness measurements in various bands, coded with these different colors, of an object which showed up in December. So it wasn't there, and then we didn't know it was there, but we had it in our data. And we've been able to construct a pretty good light curve for this guy. This one is at a redshift of 1.1. Here's another, where this data, which is taken periodically, and in which you find the supernova after the fact and then construct the light curves. Here's one that looks pretty good. Here's another one at redshift 1. Oh, and it's just a cultural thing. The Supernova Cosmology Project was using a very refined nomenclature for their supernovae. They were using composers for the high redshift ones. We use dinosaurs. Maybe something else. So here's Archaeopteryx. It turns out it's really hard to remember these. Anyway, so here's a light curve. We measure these in R, I, and a yet redder band, Z, and which is good for working at these high redshifts. Okay, so there's going to be a lot of that coming soon. And now let me tell you a little bit about the new projects. There's this ESSENCE project at CTIO, which will be done in the same way. That is, there'll be images taken of the same fields. We have half a night every other night, I think that's right, for on the CTIO 4 meter with a big CCD, and it'll produce dozens of these light curves of the type you see each year, and then we'll follow up to get redshifts. We expect over 5 years to do 200 supernovae in the zone where the effect is big. And the idea is to improve the precision of the photometry and improve the precision of the measurements so that you can see the onset of acceleration and really say something more useful about the equation of state. The first data will be coming this fall in October, so we're going to be pretty busy. Let me show you a simulation, though. Self-delusion or whatever it was, of how well you might do if you actually carry out this program on the equation of state. So here is the index W. And here are the contours you'd expect to get in the plane of W and the omega of the dark energy from the supernovae alone, and they're a little discouraging. But if you add in what seems to be a sensible idea that the space is really flat and that omega matter, total omega, is 1, except for the Cardassians, then you'd get this error ellipse. And in fact, the precision of the measurement of W could be as good as plus or minus 0.1. That would be interesting. In fact, if W turns out to be minus 1, it seems to me that's good. That shows you that you have a cosmological constant or something like it, and you've got all the problems that we heard discussed so vigorously yesterday. And if it's not 1, that's even better, because then maybe one of the crazy things we heard about yesterday is needed to understand the data. That would be extremely good. Okay. But that just tells you the value of the local value of W. It doesn't tell you about the derivative very much because the range in redshift is pretty small. What about W of Z? Well, we're not going to be able to say a great deal about it, but we will say something by going deep, as I described. So the idea is to use this new camera on the space telescope to find very distant supernovae. It's already been used to find supernovae. We found the old camera was used to find supernovae. We did that. The new camera is going to be a lot better. And then we'll take the data from the space telescope and combine it with U-band light curves taken with this will be with the CCD camera on the space telescope. And then we'll go on to get the light curve shape and the color a little bit using the infrared camera on space telescope. So let me show you how that's going to work. The idea is, there are already a couple of very deep fields with space telescope taken with the old camera, with the WIFPEC. And with the new camera called ACS, Advanced Camera for Surveys, the region of the Hubble Deep Field will be tiled in this 3x5 pattern. And what's new and what's good and what we persuaded them to do was not to do this all at once, but to do it in episodes separated by 45 days. So there'll be 5 epochs in which the survey will be done, the search will be in what's called the Z-band, which is even farther to the red than the bands I was showing you, down to an apparent magnitude of 26.5. That ought to be okay. This is in the same field where they're doing this very extensive survey that'll catalog all the galaxies and for which there'll be photometric redshifts for every one of them. So when we find one of these things, it'll probably be in a galaxy for which we already know something, at least we hope so. And we have data, we have been assigned time, Adam Rees, I knew it was one of those guys. Adam Rees is the PI for this, where for 6 of these objects that we find, we're going to be able to do the follow-up using the space telescope. So this is truly piggybacking. Yes, here's Adam Rees piggybacking on Kavalisco to find these distant supernovae. Let me show you what they're going to look like, because there's already been one found in the guaranteed time observations that were done to test out the camera. What's shown here is a picture of the Hubble Deep Field taken in the band at 814 nanometers, so out in the red. And here's another picture of that same field taken in the band at 6,000 angstroms. And down at the bottom, so what they did was they repeated, when they first repeated testing out the camera, they repeated one of these fields, and you can see this nice dot. You don't need the image subtraction software for this. You can see this nice dot, which shows you what a supernova at a redshift of 1.06 is going to look like in these data. So the answer is they are going to stick out. It's going to be really fun to do this. So the high redshift program also starts in October of 2002. For this reason, it is really important for us to get all the old stuff finished in the next month, because after that, there'll be an incredible deluge. Okay, if Saul were here, and when Saul does come, I hope he will, he would tell you that you can do all of these things much better with a dedicated satellite. There's no question that that's true. And the one that he's been proposing and promoting is this one called SNAP, which will allow you to do the kinds of things I've been talking about, but a lot more and a lot better using a dedicated satellite. Okay, so to summarize, the low redshift data is still important, and it's improving. We doubled the sample. It raises the bar. It's going to be harder to double it again. I think we can do that one more time than somebody else. The middle redshift data, the stuff at a redshift of a half that I showed you, the preliminary data, looks good. And we'll publish that soon. Lambda still looks good. There's this program we call ESSENS, to get W to plus or minus a tenth in the at a redshift of a half, roughly speaking, where the effect is big. And this program on the space telescope to see supernovae at higher redshift, which will give us much more information about this turning over, and I think give us a lot more confidence about whether we're really seeing cosmology or some other thing in the supernova data. There's no question that if you put in the time and treasure to build SNAP, you can do this better. We just thought anything worth doing is worth doing badly. The concordance of the supernova data, the CMB data, and the omega matter data from clusters, I think, is more convincing than any single approach. And the fact that all of these threads, which are pretty much independent, have come together in the same place and more or less at the same time is what makes this so exciting. Thank you very much. Yeah, the question is, what about the expanding photosphere method? When I was a graduate student at Caltech, I invented the expanding, I sound like Zwicky, I invented the expanding photosphere method, which allows you to measure the distance to a supernova without any other astronomical distance, just by looking at the temperature, the flux, and the velocity in the atmosphere. And that has been improved quite a bit recently by Mario Amui using infrared observations to figure out how to do this. The problem is that the type II supernovae, the ones for which this applies, are not as bright as the type I, so you can't go as far out. But I think there's a lot of unexplored possibility. After all, it would be good to do 20 or 50 of these out in the Hubble flow to check the Hubble constant to start with. And it will certainly be the case that in this very, very deep survey with the Space Telescope, some of the objects will turn out to be type IIs, and it may be that even at larger redshifts, like a half or one, you'll be able to say something intelligent about the distance to those type IIs using this sort of thing. The answer is, yes, there's potential, and people haven't developed it as much as the type IAs. The rise time?
Yeah, and there was
I mean, it's a tempest in a teapot. There were some preliminary conference proceedings, abstracts and so on from the SCP that claimed that the rise time was more rapid for the distant ones than for the nearby ones. And so we look really hard at the rise time for the nearby ones to try to improve that. And they looked again at the data from the distant ones in their sample. And the upshot is there's no discernible difference. That is the sort of thing you'd like to look for, though, because you want to be on guard against the sample somehow drifting, that the distant supernovae somehow come from a different population than the nearby ones. So that's the kind of thing people will be looking at again.
Two things. The first question, what if dust is clumpy?
What if dust is clumpy? Yeah. yes. Oh, you mean gray dust?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So one of the ways to get the observations that we see without having a cosmological constant would be to say, oh, you're seeing supernovae which are 25% faint. But they're not 25% faint because of acceleration. They're 25% faint because of some dust which you haven't accounted for correctly. We say, but we understand dust and we measure all these colors, which is not entirely true. And it's also possible to concoct dust which has a different size distribution so that it has absorption but not reddening, the thing that we use to measure how much dust is along the line of sight. So you can invent pixie dust, which will have exactly the right properties to make the supernovae dim and not to do, not have other effects. We, in 1999, we undertook a set of observations to test that. Turns out that you can't make really gray dust because the ratio of the size of the scatterer to the wavelength changes if you change the wavelength, which we can do by observing over a wide wavelength range. So we have observed a handful of supernovae very, very well over a wide wavelength range from the ultraviolet out into the infrared. And that's where the signature of dust, which won't be perfectly gray but a little bit pink, will show up. And we've did it thoroughly for one object which was published, that's 1999Q, where there's no evidence for gray dust. And we have a handful more for which we have very nice data that's in process. So we'll get that done. I hope not by October though.
My other comment was, they may have taken photos of Einstein at Blackboard, but you are being videotaped.
Good point. But the medium will change. This stuff, they won't be able to read the tapes. It'll be on.
I wonder, you showed some new results with the quantitative numbers.
Well, I showed you the omega-omega plot.
Yeah.
Did you like that? Well, they're the same. The numbers are pretty much the same. That is, the best value of omega matter and omega lambda, yeah, it's a little higher for omega lambda, sort of 0.8 and 0.2. But we'll see how, I mean, the reason they are preliminary is that the hard part is the photometry. It's the actual measurement of the brightness and the calibration of the other stars that you use to compare the supernova to. Turned out in this case to be extremely complicated, and we're pretty much done with that. I don't think the numbers are going to change, but I wouldn't want to I wouldn't want to say that there's going to be no change before we are finally done.
Because there was change last month, and it made me very cross.
That's done in flux.
Just
the way you said. Yeah. Yeah. We were educable.
What would happen if you did the entire analysis without doing any of this multi light
curve? Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, suppose you didn't do this light curve stuff. It turns out, because that sounds very mysterious, second parameters, you know. It turns out you would get the result. The error bars would be a little bigger. I think part of the reason why our error bars are smaller than the SCP error bars for the low redshift ones is that we have a more thorough way of doing that analysis. But if you don't do it, you still get the effect. So it doesn't depend critically on that. I think it is the right thing to do, that the supernovae that decline fast are dimmer, and you're making an error to assign them a larger distance when you know that they're intrinsically dimmer. But even if you don't do that, you do see the effect.
Okay.